Hello and welcome to Next Week in Your Practice Session. In this session, Bill O'Hanlon joins Drs. Rick Hansen and Ruth Baczynski to give you concrete strategies you can use in your life and work with patients. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist, inspirational speaker, and author of more than 35 books. Welcome to Next Week in Your Practice.
What stood out to you most in the webinar with Daniel Amen? And Bill, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, the thing that I'm so impressed with Daniel Amen is he really talks about the brain like the rest of us talk about the heart or the muscles. You have to keep it in shape and you have to be careful that it doesn't get damaged. I've just been doing some research because I have a new book coming out about depression and about brain injury being associated with long-term risks for depression. Because we know that the brain is such an important organ. And I think what I got from this whole thing was Dan Amen was talking about how to keep your brain healthy and alive. It's almost like exercising your muscles. You need to take care of it nutritionally, sleep-wise, relationship-wise, stress-wise. And that really stood out for me. It's like, wow, we don't really think so much about taking care of our brains like we think about taking care of our hearts, our muscles, the rest of our bodies. And we're learning so much more about how to care for your brain, how to make sure it functions all through life as a learning machine and as something that keeps you happy and healthy.
Thanks, Bill. I think that's a good point. We'll get more into that a little later. Rick, how about you? What stood out most to you?
Related to Bill's comment, really appreciating the biochemical underpinnings of our moment-to-moment experiencing and how we act and how we feel. In other words, you know, Dr. Amen was pointing out how the rise and fall or individual variations of things like thyroid and estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, neurotransmitters like serotonin and so forth really shape mood, attitude, inclinations, and our everyday experience of living. And one of the hopeful takeaways from that, of course, is that there are things we can do to adjust those levels or balances or equilibria in such a way that's really good for a person. And I found that really hopeful. And also it goes to the key point of being a friend to yourself. I think about how so many people are alienated in a way from their own bodies and how important it is to come into the body and really care for it. And I think Dr. Amen was pointing out, first, the importance of doing that, and second, the opportunity in terms of adjusting your own biochemical levels, that there's a lot that a person can do on their own with some guidance and thoughtfulness.
Yeah, and to tie that to what Bill said, you know, we are, perhaps we've thought for a long time about taking care of our bodies, but we're late to the idea about taking care of our brains. That's almost been a removed thing that, you know, it was a matter of luck. You got a good brain or you didn't. And we went from there. But it's exciting to hear all the information so that if we're motivated, we can take care of our brains. Bill, Daniel argues that the female brain is hardwired for leadership. How can women access those parts of the brain?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I was trained as a marriage and family therapist. I remember one time hearing a great quotation from one of my couples. The female in the couple said, she didn't, you know, she was worried about her husband because he was distant and he'd had an affair before when he was distant. It turned out he just had a cold. And he said, she kept asking me how I'm feeling. He said, I'm the last person to know how I feel. And I love that quotation. He was aware enough to know that he didn't know, but she knew much quicker than he did what was going on. And this is going to sound a little obsequious, but I think one of the ways that women can model, to be leaders, is to be models. And I have to give you credit. I tend to be a little impulsive in my life. You know this, Ruth, because we've known each other for some years, and a little scattered. And one of the things that you've done is help me focus more and also to up my game. I tend to be, that's good enough. I kind of impulsive. I do it and I get it done. And you and my fiance, Helen, have both kind of shown me You know, the first iteration is probably not your best effort, Bill. You can do a little better. Go back to it. And I've gone back to it again. And I think I've seen you do that. But, you know, I think people who watch this series will get that. But I've known you personally for a long time, and I've modeled you. So I think one of the ways women can be leaders is to be models, to be really good models. I've certainly modeled on women that I cared about or admired and tried to develop more of what's not natural for me that I see they seem to be really good at.
Okay. And thank you, Bill. Rick, Daniel mentions that sometimes a little bit of worry can be a good thing. How can we find a balance between too much worry and not enough worry?
Right. It's natural to worry, which is actually reassuring for people who worry, because they start to worry about worrying, for example. And animals back in the day that did not worry, they got eaten. So it's normal to worry. The question is, of course, the right balance. And I think paradoxically that what someone can do is think of worry as like a good friend inside themselves who's doing the best that it can. And if you befriend that worry voice rather than push it away, it actually starts calming down. It feels listened to. It feels heard. And then you can put what it's saying to you in perspective. You can avoid the pitfall of what I call paper tiger paranoia, this idea that as we move through life, we tend to overestimate threats and underestimate resources and opportunities. You can bring into yourself a kind of a correction factor and ask yourself, is what I'm worrying about actually realistic? Is my worry in proportion to what I'm worrying about? And is there any action that would be appropriate for me to take to deal with my worry? And then when I've done everything I can, at this point, can I let myself come to peace with this? Or can, and also, can I appreciate that excess worry is a kind of affliction upon my own mind? When I started using that word affliction to think about my own worrying, my own unnecessary worrying, it was really helpful to me. And I also began to appreciate that a lot of my worry was just noise. It's like a false alarm, like a car alarm going off in the distance, you know? It doesn't mean anything. It's unpleasant, but it's not a useful signal. It's not informative in any way. Anyway, so that those have been helpful for me in terms of finding that sweet spot with worry. You know, it's the Goldilocks place, not too tall, not too short, not too hot, not too cold, that just right place where there's the just the right amount of worry.
So, Rick, how do we, I get the point about the right amount of worry, not too much, not enough, and just enough, not too much. But the idea of befriending the worrier in us, how do we do that?
I think some people think of it as like a little person, like the mind is a bit like a committee, a group of people sitting around a table. And you know, there's usually that person on every committee, right, who annoys other people, but really has a good heart and is trying to help, right? Mm-hmm. And just needs to be regulated a little bit by the chair of the committee. You could think of that as, you know, Daniel Amen talked about the prefrontal cortex as the chair of the committee. And so the thing is, if you get mad at that person in your committee, it doesn't help things because you can't get them out of your head anyway. They're in the committee, right? You can't, but they have a lifetime appointment to the committee. So I think if you relate to it as almost like a person and sympathize with its aims, it's well intended. The worry voice is designed to keep you alive. It's there to promote your survival. It might be going about it, though, in an excessive way with a lot of alarmism that's just out of proportion. So I think it's like being a good parent in a way, to be both nurturing and accepting and appreciating to that part of yourself, but also having a certain firmness and not letting it run the committee.
Thanks. Bill, how can we balance our hormones? That's something that and maybe that's a broad question, but something that Dr. Amen talked about a lot, and you got the sense of how important it was to have a balance. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, without taking hormones directly, I think that we found a bunch of things in recent years that indirectly, it's like influencing the brain. You can't go right into the brain and tweak around with unless you're a surgeon. But you can do some things indirectly. And I think the same thing about hormones. We know exercise. I mean, if I just said one thing to everybody, exercise, movement, don't even call it exercise, just movement. If you move regularly, it's not only good for your heart, it's good for your muscles, good for your aerobics, you know, all that cancer prevention. But we know it's good for them, regulating the hormones and the brain, obviously, stress reduction. I used to have a crazy stressful life. So if you can just do a couple of things to take a couple of stretches down a notch, and then, you know, taking a cue from Rick, who's talked about this kind of taking in the good, is doing forgiveness. We know that from positive psychology. If you've just got, there are some things that are just ongoing stresses. If you can reduce some of those, you have some resentments from the past. Your mind in some way is still stuck on those. If you can take those down, having more laughter, having more joy, getting more sleep. There are pretty straightforward things that can indirectly regulate the hormones. Obviously, nutritional things, as Dr. Avon was talking about.
And staying with hormones, Rick, Daniel talked about the stress, what we refer to as the stress hormone, which is cortisol, and how detrimental that can sometimes be to brain cells. What are some ways that people can keep that cortisol level balanced?
Right. There are a lot of ways to handle stress, so I thought of two that might be relatively fresh for people. The first is pleasure. Pleasure experiences, obviously wholesome pleasures, you know, like rubbing flannel against your cheek or putting your hands in warm water, eating something good or seeing something beautiful or putting on a jacket or sweater if you're starting to get cold. Ordinary pleasure is designed by Mother Nature to bring us out of spikes of, I call it red zone stress, and start initiating a soothing and calming cascade. So little moments of pleasure when you're stressed that are appropriate, like literally exhaling or feeling something that feels good, can actually start to bring you out of that burst of stress, which is, of course, associated with a spike in cortisol production. The second thing I would suggest is to look for opportunities for what have been traditionally called refuges. I mean, when we're stressed, we feel by nature invaded. Things are getting us and they're rattling us, right? That's the very nature of stress. And so on the other hand, if people look for those physical places that are calming and centering, a special place in your house or a corner in your room that looks good, or a person you can talk to who's a refuge, that's great. But also inner refuges. You know, a sense of finding a purpose in what you're doing, to feel really rattled and busy with no sense of purpose is deeply stressful. But studies of combat soldiers and others in terrible conditions have shown that as long as you have a sense of purpose and meaning in what you're doing, a sense that this is going somewhere or there's a larger frame for what you're experiencing, that too is very calming for people. That buffers them from the sense of stress. And last, another refuge, of course, is your own inner sense of some calm, centered place inside that's never penetrated by the storms that rage around you. They're real, they're unpleasant, they're challenging, but it's some deep place inside your home in yourself. And as people can cultivate that sense of being home in themselves, that gives them a stable kind of buoy, I think of it, that they can hold on to even as the storms make the waves go up and down.
You know, you were talking about pleasure, and one of the things you didn't talk about, but you have other times, is pets. And yeah, all three of us have a cat.
Yeah.
And enjoy the pleasures of having a cat.
It's
and
true.
I noticed that I just feel different sometimes just looking at a picture of a cat. But I think we should change life and have cats at our at our offices, and I remember for one of our conferences, someone was training a seeing eye dog, and so the dog had to learn to be in meetings and things like that. And this was a kind of a puppy. Oh, she was so sweet. It was just so sweet to see that everyone would, you know, during the breaks, gather around the dog because she was so precious.
If only we could bottle purring and actually have it, carry it around with us next to our heart. Oh, I think that would be a big cortisol decreaser in life. Purring.
I think you're right, Bill. Okay, I've got one last question, but I'd like to ask you both. A lot of Daniel's recent work, and certainly one of his most recent books, has focused on the differences between the female and the male brain. Do you think we should be approaching men and women differently in our work? A lot of people here work with people. Either they're a manager or a teacher or a counselor or any kind of practitioner, a life coach. And for goodness sakes, many people are parents. Do you have thoughts on that? Do we want to think in terms of approaching women differently than men, or what are your thoughts on that? Well, let's start with you, Bill.
Okay, I guess I would say I had four kids, and they were all different. And one of them was a female, and three of them were males. And I'm not sure I would classify those differences. The female was a rugby player. She was tough. She went to become a counselor. And it wasn't for her. She wasn't that empathic. She was a little more, she wanted to slap people and say, get over it. And some of the males were way more empathic. So I think one of the things that this points out is that, you know, I've been a counselor for a lot of years, and sometimes I joke, every counseling session is a cross-counseling session. That is, everybody's culture is different. Every child is different. Every employee is different. And I think we have to be careful about generalizing about people or about males and females. So I like this. If the female brain, as Daniel Amen says, is more oriented towards detecting errors, I think then it's a good fix to be able to notice what works. You know, again, back to Rick's work and my work in solution-oriented therapy is finding the good and what's working to balance, not just to deny and say, oh, you know, you're so focused on what's wrong. No, just to balance it out a little. But I think when I think about approaching people, kids, employees, clients, you know, coaching clients, therapy clients, everybody's an individual. And I think that we're finding that about the brains. There are some generalizations, and everybody's an individual.
Rick, how about you?
Boy, I would really second that emotion, Bill, all the way around. And I'm leery, I guess, of the generalization of the male brain and the female brain for a couple of reasons. One is that, as we all know, historically, whatever differences that do exist have typically been used against women. Mm-hmm. And so just entering into the conversation about differences, I think we need to keep that in mind. The second thing is, of course, the distinction between innate and acquired. In other words, while some differences can be found between the average male and average female brains at, let's say, age 35, how many of those differences were innate rather than acquired due to the different kind of socialization that boys and girls, men and women experience? And then last, as Bill points out, there are really tremendous individual differences. I mean, for example, the range of variation between the average male and average female brain is really pretty small. But the average variation among all female brains and among all male brains is much greater than the average difference between a female and a male brain. So I guess the net takeaway for me as well with what Bill said is to think of it as cross-cultural differences and to be careful, I guess, to be careful about my own assumptions about who I'm dealing with. I've definitely put my foot in the mouth, my mouth, no one else's mouth, by stepping into situations based on a kind of assumption about the way somebody really is based on first impressions, including that kind of sorting about gender. All that said, on the other hand, I've known people who really felt like they were seen clearly for the first time when they were described in a genderized kind of way. It's like, oh, you really get me as an X, you know? You really get me as a woman. Thank you. Or you really get me as a man. Thank you. So I guess, you know, netting it all out, you can err on either side, I think. You can, on the one hand, quickly overgeneralize, and unfortunately language makes us do that by talking about the male brain or the female brain, when in fact there are a lot of differences. On the other hand, I think sometimes, I'll speak for myself, I've been so worried about political correctness that I haven't been willing to name what was right in front of my face, which was that this person, let's say, was a very masculine kind of man or a very feminine kind of woman, and that was part of the picture and important to acknowledge.
Thanks, everyone, for being a part of this. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching this session. We hope you'll go ahead and take these ideas and begin using them in your work. In Part 4, you'll find your quick start guide. It's an at-a-glance reference to the most critical concepts and practices from this short course. You'll be able to use this to refresh your memory so you'll feel confident in turning these insights into action. And in part 5, you'll find the transcripts. You'll be able to download, print, and refer to these professionally formatted transcripts as often as you like. Thanks again for watching.